Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. I'm the pastor of Hope OPC in Grays Lake, Illinois. And I'm back today with a wonderful discussion. We have an important one I've been looking forward to. And we've got some great panelists and guests. Let me introduce to you first one of our panelists and regulars, Jared Oliphant, who works for Westminster Theological Seminary out of Charlotte, North Carolina. Welcome back, Jared. It's good to have you.
Thanks, Camden. Good to be on.
We also have his father, one of our special guests. We enjoy having him back, Dr. Scott Oliphant, who teaches systematic theology and apologetics at Westminster. Welcome back, Dr. Oliphant. It's good to have you with us again.
Thanks a lot, Camden.
Today, we are looking at a book by Cornelius Van Til. We have another new edition. Very excited to receive this from PNR. We have Van Til's Christian Theistic Evidences, a second edition now, which includes the complete text of the original 1978 edition, including a new foreword by Dr. O, as well as footnotes and explanatory material along the way. This is an important book. We're going to open it up and discuss it today. It's another one in the series of these new editions on Van Til's works. And I'm looking forward to that. But before we get into it, I've got a few things to mention. First, we should let everyone know that we have a conference coming up in the Lone Star State. We're looking forward to a one-day conference, Saturday, April 30th, 2016, in case somebody's listening in many years down the road. And we don't want you to show up some random April 30th. But Saturday, April 30th, 2016, we'll be down near Austin, Texas. We have two OP churches down there. Glenn Clary is a pastor in Pflugerville, Texas, and Jim Cassidy is a pastor in South Austin, Texas. And we're going to have our conference at, I believe it's Covenant or Providence. I always get this mixed up with Houston. We're going to have a conference in Pflugerville, and we're looking forward to welcoming you down. There's information on the website at reformedforum.org/conference on how to attend and who will be speaking and what the subject will be. So there's a lot of fun stuff, and it'll be our first foray into a Reformed Forum event down in Texas. I know my two conversation partners will be excited about us heading down to the Lone Star State.
Yes.
Should be all the much better theology because it's
occurring in Texas. That's still my presbytery, you know.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we're looking forward to connecting with your presbytery mates down there and having a good time. So, do we have any other events? Jared, you're moving around. You got anything that you're going to be heading to soon?
Yeah, something that's coming up in about a month or so. For those who know, the Together for the Gospel conference is every other year, and it's coming up this year in mid-April. And so Westminster's going to have a booth there. I'll be there. And we're going to have a Westminster faculty panel that is talking about, well, the theme of Together for the Gospel this year, it's a year early, but it's basically about Protestantism, celebrating the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. And so we thought we would keep within that theme. And the title of our faculty panel, it's with Dr. Oliphant, it's with Jeffrey Jew, and then Johnny Gibson, who's coming on as a faculty member in Old Testament. And the title is, How Protestant Are You? And so we're going to be getting into a lot of topics, actually, that we're going to be discussing today, like issues in apologetics, defending the faith, scripture, role of scripture, even things like worship and the sacraments and those kinds of things. So that panel is going to be Wednesday afternoon, and it should be good. It should be a good time. Even for OPC pastors, it's a good, or, you know, members, that crew. I've been there a few times and can definitely vouch for it. So if you're around there, come say hey.
Mm-hmm. There's thousands of people there, and it's a very special conference. So I'm glad you're able to be there and that you're able to put on a wonderful panel, and I'm sure many people might want to connect. If they do want to connect, what's the best way to get in touch with you and or Westminster?
Yeah, good questions. You could email me. It's just joliphant@wts.edu. That's probably the best way to start, and we can take it from there.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Well, today we're looking at speaking about Christian theistic evidences. Evidences is always an important subject whenever we're looking at apologetics. And I've got this copy before me. I have a PDF copy here of the new edition. Looking forward to getting a hard copy. But on my shelf, I have this entire set of these older volumes published by the Den Dolk Foundation back in the day. And Christian Theistic Evidences here, an important one, volume 6 of the series in defense of biblical Christianity. Dr. Oliphant, we know that you've edited several of these volumes in the past, and that Dr. Edgar also has edited two of them, I believe, Christian Apologetics and Introduction to Systematic Theology. Can you speak about this book in relation to Van Til's larger corpus? Where does this book fit in, and what are some of the bigger themes as we begin our discussion today?
Right. Well, a number of the syllabuses that he wrote were eventually published, as you mentioned, by the Dindalk Foundation. And so as he began to write those and rewrite those, he knew that there was going to be a publication at some point. In some ways, that didn't change much of what he wrote, but he did try to write a bit more and try to provide chapters and that sort of thing. But the numbering of the volumes, as I understand it, was fairly arbitrary.
Right.
It was just a matter of what was published first and then what next and what next. Defense of the Faith, for example, was one of the few books that Van Til wrote for publication. He wanted that to be published. It was not a syllabus first, although he pulled some of his syllabus material out to put in there. Same with Christian Theory of Knowledge. But Christian Theistic Evidences, Christian Theistic Ethics, Intro to Systematic Theology, those were all first syllabuses and then revised and reworked just a bit before Dindalk put them into publication. He was concerned just to get Van Til's material out. Van Til was not at that point wanting to do much writing beyond what he was doing for the classroom. So it worked well in the sense that Dindalk was ready and willing financially to make sure that these publications were distributed. So it was great for PNR to be able to do that through the Dindalk Foundation.
Now, some people might wonder what we mean by syllabus, because you might be thinking of, you know, 1 to 4 page piece of paper with dates and assignments and assigned readings and course policies. But, you know, that's not what we're speaking about. What did Van Til provide for his students in his classes?
Well, he provided copious notes and ideas, and essentially he would provide a notebook for them. Kind of the way to think about it is a notebook on the topic. If you look at the material in the archives in the library from way back, these are just mimeographed notebooks that he's handing out to the students. And he would give them those and oftentimes just go through them. And then his teaching style was he wouldn't get through the syllabus or the notebook. He would go off on explanatory material, which would have been helpful to the rest of us if that would have been written down. But he used it for the classroom as kind of a springboard to teach on the topic. When I had Van Til's successor, Dr. Knudsen, in class, he did the same thing. He would hand out pages and pages and pages of notes, and then he didn't veer much from those. So he would basically read the notes that he handed out to students, and many students sort of got the idea, well, we don't need to be here as long as we have the notes. So it didn't help classroom attendance, but that was the way that Dr. Knudsen was taught, and so that's the way that he did it in his classroom. That's what Van Til wanted to do. He wanted the students to have not just an outline, but he wanted them to have the actual material that he was going to present to them.
Mm-hmm. Now, along with the explanatory notes, which are helpful labor that you have provided for us, we, you know, did not have the privilege of sitting in Dr. Van Til's classes. Some of them are available through Westminster's audio library. You can visit wts.edu and sign up there. You'll find links to how to get to it over on the sidebar somewhere. It's on the webpage. I don't have it in front of me, but you can download some of his classes. But if you had not had the privilege of sitting in his class, you might be confused by some things. So one of the great values in this new series, in these second or third editions, these later editions, is that we do have some footnotes explaining some of the context, because some of the polemical context has slipped from our recent memory. There's also helpful footnotes, you know, references to other materials, and also some explanations that are just helpful, because some things are a little bit obscure. But along with all of that, which is important in its own right, you have written a foreword here in the book, as you've done in previous editions, looking at Defense of the Faith, for example, or Survey of Christian Epistemology. What are some important things about this book, Christian Theistic Evidences, that warrants its republication, not just as an historical document, but as something that is applicable in a new way?
I think a number of ways to answer that question. The practical answer is I still require it for my second year apologetics
right.
course, and You know, and having students read that syllabus just as it is, even in its last iteration in the 1970s, it still just reads as a bit dated. And so I thought it was useful, necessary, practically to put something in their hands that was updated a little bit. But more importantly, and this is one of the things I say in the foreword, this was the first syllabus that Van Til began to write when he was hired at Westminster. And when he was working on the syllabus in the summer before he was coming back, he was not on campus or in Philadelphia at the time. He went west and was working on the syllabus and recognized as he began to work on it that even though he had just joined an institution that was wanting to be, by Machen's design, a continuation of old Princeton, Van Til recognized in the initial writing of his material that he was going to have to veer away from what old Princeton had been teaching about evidences.
Yeah.
So Van Til writes to Machen, the letters are still available, and he says, I just want to make sure, you know, in effect, he's saying, I want to make sure that you're okay with this, that I'm going to be doing this, not only writing the syllabus, but I'm going to be critical of old Princeton. And Machen says to Van Til, and I'm quoting Machen, he says, your choice of topics is sure to be better than mine ever would be. And then Machen says to Van Til in a letter, he says, I wish I could take your course in evidences. I need it. And I'm sure it's greatly to the benefit of the seminary that you're offering it. So Machen, in a sense, said, you do what you need to do because I know what you will do with this. And as a matter of fact, I wish I could sit in on the course. So that was a real affirmation for Van Til. And that's what he needed at that point, because he wanted to be clear that Westminster is the continuation of old Princeton in substance, but, and this is the second point that I think is worth noting, Van Til recognized as he was writing the syllabus that he was going to have to disagree with the apologetics that he had learned at Princeton Seminary under William Brenton Greene Jr. And it's important to see this because there's still a good bit of discussion out there about how Reformed was old Princeton. And I think Van Til would say thoroughly Reformed theologically. But then what about the criticisms that have come to old Princeton with respect to various aspects such as common sense realism, but also with respect to their apologetics? And I think it's important to see that Van Til's critique is not one of a scholar who's sitting in his study reading manuscripts from old Princeton or books or articles from old Princeton. Van Til was in it. He sat there as a student and he took the course from William Brenton Greene Jr. And it did not compute for him with everything else that he was learning at old Princeton, everything that he had learned at Calvin in his reading of Kuyper and Bobbing. So one of the things I do in the foreword is I actually got a hold of Greene's syllabus in apologetics from old Princeton and supply a few quotations there to show that what Greene was teaching in apologetics at Princeton, as Van Til makes clear, was consistent not with the theology that Van Til was learning at Princeton, but was consistent with Butler's analogy, with a more Arminian approach to apologetics. Yeah. That's where Van Til had to be critical. He didn't do it lightly, and he didn't do it happily. So that if you read Van Til in his overall assessment of William Brenton Greene Jr., he speaks of him as his honored professor and speaks very highly of him in various places because he loved him as a professor. But as Van Til was wont to do, he knew that he had to be critical of the theology that was undergirding Greene's apologetic and to reorient that more toward a Reformed theology. So he has the imprimatur from Machen, but he also has the unhappy task, I think he would have said in his own mind, to have to come against his revered professor and to begin to develop an understanding of evidences that is more consistent with the theology of the Reformation. And that's what he begins to do. And I think it's important. That's why when you see these syllabuses, the same with the ethics syllabus, Van Til will entitle it Christian theistic, not just theistic evidences. That's not what he wants.
Right.
But whatever he wants has to be Christian theistic, so that there is a Trinitarian, solidly Trinitarian foundation.
Yeah, not just proving some that a God exists or some abstract God exists, but specifically the triune God of the Bible.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so it has to presuppose Christianity and not theism, and that's an important point for Van Til.
That's huge.
So off he goes to begin. And it's and the other thing, if I could just mention this, as he begins to think about what do I need to teach these second-year seminary students, the first thing that comes to his mind is evidences. Now, if we know the history of apologetics in the 20th century and beyond, and the way in which it's discussed, usually what people say is you're either presuppositionalist or you're evidentialist. And I think that is such a caricature. I saw it recently, again, the way it's presented in a wonderful book that I very much enjoyed reading by Oz Guinness, called Fool's Talk on Persuasion. And Oz always writes in a wonderful way, and I love to read what he writes. But he's still under the illusion in that book and in various places that it's either presuppositionalism or evidentialism. That just can't hold water given the history of what Van Til was trying to do in the first place in the 1930s when he's writing this. There is no presuppositionalism. There's no ism attached to what he's doing. He's just working with Reformed apologetics. The ism factor really didn't come in until the late 40s when there was a label attached to it. And in the second place, the first thing that he wants to do is to help these seminary students, these pastors in training, to understand how we as Christians, and particularly in apologetics, ought to view evidences. So there is a way to view that. As a matter of fact, I think it is, in my view, the only biblical way to view evidences in the context of apologetics. So Van Til's approach is not opposed to evidences. It embraces it and discusses it, and I think has the most robust view of what evidences ought to be in our apologetics. Mm.
It's so important that you mention the letter that Machen wrote. I'm fascinated by that Machen himself would have acknowledged that he was in need of taking Van Til's class on evidences and would have no doubt been open to hearing what Van Til would have been teaching, and that Van Til had some imprimatur or blessing to divert a bit from what old Princeton was doing. There's somewhat of a reigning idea, maybe it's not reigning, but there's an idea out there. I believe an article that was written in New Horizons or Ordained Servant years ago by Hart and Mather, an article that I appreciate, but it was an article that seemed to indicate that the number one, if not the exclusive reason that Machen really needed Van Til was to have another name or another person who taught at Princeton to try to establish some bridge or continuity to the new seminary therein at Westminster. But this letter seems to demonstrate much more that Machen saw something more in him rather than just a token figure.
Yeah, and I think that has to be said. I mean, Machen was not a pragmatist. He's not just looking for another Princeton person to bring into Westminster to sort of stick it in their face and even if that was a part of what Machen was up to, he had seen Van Til in action at Princeton, and he knew what Van Til could do. And the way when you start reading these letters, and you know, the quote I gave you is right out of Mather's biography, which I hardly commend. When you start reading these letters, I think you recognize a couple of things. Number one, Machen had great respect for Van Til's intellectual and academic ability, and it was Machen who encouraged Van Til to get a hold of Barth, and he said, you'll be able to do what I couldn't do in analyzing Barth's theology. And as we all know, that became somewhat of an obsession in Van Til's life as he began to read and think through all that. He latched on like a pit bull, never let go. But conversely, on the other side, Van Til wrote in a letter how frustrated he himself was that he couldn't communicate in his writing as clearly as Machen could. So you've got this kind of give and take back and forth. Machen respects Van Til for his academic prowess and his intellectual ability, and Van Til wishes he could express himself as clearly as Machen was able to do.
Yeah.
And you know, when I first met Van Til, he talked in, one of those times when I wish I'd had an Apple iPhone, you know, which had been invented about 30 years earlier, because I could have just turned it on. But he talked endlessly, story after story, about Machen and what he and Machen had talked about with respect to the seminary and old Princeton and Warfield and all these kinds of discussions. And I was just, you know, sitting there with my mouth open, but not able to record it. So the respect he had for Machen, I think, was great. And part of that was because of Machen's unqualified support of everything Van Til wanted to do in apologetics. And that's why he asked him three times. Two times Van Til said no. The third time, face-to-face, he said, okay, I'll come. But that's why, you know, Machen, he was not casual about getting Van Til, and it was not for some psychological reason sort of say, okay, we need somebody. It was because he knew this man could do what needed to be done at the seminary.
It's like a Pharrell Calvin type experience.
Exactly. That's exactly what it was. Yeah.
Except I don't think he offered him a year's supply of wine.
Well, if it was Van Til, he would have offered him a year's supply of beer.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I know we can't park all day on old Princeton and that connection, but it does occur to me as more works from Voss and his systematic theology come up that have you seen Van Til interacting with, I know you don't think of Voss as an apologist, but clearly there are some things there that were influential for Van Til, and we've said that many times. How does Voss's approach, or maybe I should ask it this way, is there any indication specifically from Van Til that Voss's approach early on there was an influence in specific ways regarding this question? And the kind of corollary to this is, I'm thinking particularly of that book, Plundering the Egyptians, that has a history of actually Westminster's Old Testament department, but back of it, Old Princeton's and Robert Dick Wilson. And in that, it seems like Robert Dick Wilson had a very different approach to Old Testament extra-biblical literature and those kinds of things and evidences regarding Old Testament apologetics. So I know that's a ton to think about, but I'm just thinking about that seminal time there in the late 20s, early 30s where all this was going on. So any idea on the connection between Voss and maybe even the line of Robert Dick Wilson and others in biblical studies?
Yeah, I don't know so much in terms of biblical studies. I do know that there were things that needed to be corrected with regard to extra scriptural evidences and the way that we think about those from Old Princeton into Westminster. And I do know also in this early edition of evidences and into the later one, the last edition, Van Til has a chapter on teleology where he's talking about philosophy of history. He doesn't cite Voss in any extensive way in any of his writings. And I think what you have to see in Van Til is that the Vossian influence is behind everything he's doing. But Voss wasn't doing apologetics specifically for most of his writing. But I don't think I think Van Til would be clear that he wouldn't be able to do what he did without a redemptive historical understanding that Voss had had given to him, and the respect for the two was great, of course.
Mm. And another thing, a very important and significant thing that you bring up here in the foreword is the common sense problem, where you write here, the root of the problem in the old Princeton apologetic, as well as in elements of Hermann Bavinck's theology, was some version of the Reedian common sense realism that had gained some ascendancy after the skepticism of David Hume had become obvious. We'll get to Hume a little bit later. There's an entire chapter on Hume and one on Bishop Butler's analogy, which I want to open up there as well. But this sets the stage for the present-day applicability. All of it's applicable, of course. We can always find connections and apply, but there seems to be a very significant connection here between this particular volume written years ago and what we found today, even in Christian philosophy, in analytic philosophy. What can be said about this common sense problem, and how does Van Til approach it?
Yeah, when he's critiquing Green, and I try to bring this up in the foreword because you can see it in Green's syllabus. He recognizes that Green's understanding of reason. And and that's a loaded category. I recognize that, but his understanding of the way in which our minds typically work, let's put it that way, is not sufficiently critical, so that in the way Van Til would put it, so that every fact is necessarily, first of all, if it is going to be known truly has to be known as a created fact. And that's going to make a difference in the way that you think about your methodology. So I'm not positive that Green would have said outright that he's a common sense realist in the traditional way, but there's no question in his syllabus that he says explicitly that he owes a debt to McCosh, who was, if we know our history, who was a common sense realist and influential at Princeton. So I'm not a historian. I don't know how those influences sort of would weave their way in and out of the different theological disciplines there. But that it was influential, there can be no question in terms of what's written in the syllabuses and what was given in the classrooms. And Van Til was very, very critical of that. That ism, because any ism that is not Christian theism is by definition an idol. Mm-hmm. Now that sort of one of the reasons I like my students in the second year class to read this work is because the ideas that Van Til presents in that book, even though the names won't be as familiar, and I try to give at least a sort of quick definition of who these people are that he's dealing with. But even though the names might be not be familiar, the ideas and concepts are just as relevant today as they were when Van Til was writing in the summer of 1930. And one of the examples of that I bring up in the foreword is the material from Alvin Plantinga and the way in which he has developed his so-called proper function epistemology. And that epistemology, Plantinga himself has called Reedian, meaning it is consistent with and in many ways dependent on the common sense philosophy of Thomas Reed. So what Plantinga is attempting to do is to say that there is a kind of, there is necessarily in epistemology a realism such that we have foundational beliefs which by themselves are not in need of any justification, and from those beliefs then we can infer other beliefs. And so the argument that Plantinga sets out to make is which beliefs can we say are foundational, and in what way are they foundational? He calls them properly basic. So that just goes right back to Princeton. It's interesting that Plantinga wants to say that that he's initially, he wanted to say this is a reformed epistemology because he was saying, I'm saying what Calvin and Kuyper and Bobbing, and he even includes Bard in that, unfortunately. But he says, I'm saying what all these men have said. I'm trying to say it in a more consistently philosophical and epistemological way. Mm-hmm. So what Van Til is critiquing in Green is now present again in Plantinga, and I think destructively so, if what we want is a consistently Christian epistemology. Now, that's not to say, let me just be clear, that much of Plantinga's work is not brilliant. It certainly is. But foundationally, as an epistemology, I don't think Reformed folk want to get into a notion of arguing the proper basicality of theistic belief. I think that brings us right back. The similarities between Plantinga and Old Princeton and Butler on analogy are striking, and I think that needs to be brought out more, because I'm afraid that there's a good bit of influence out there from Plantinga, rightly so in one sense because of his brilliance, but theologically is going to be destructive if it's just brought in wholesale.
Let's speak about that. That's the first chapter of Van Til's book here, chapter one, The History of Evidence, is you have Butler's analogy. Who was Bishop Butler? What were his times, and what is Van Til reacting to, his significant work here?
Yeah, well, he's important not because he's so relevant today, because most people wouldn't have read The Analogy of Religion. It was a highly, massively influential book when it was written in the 18th century. Butler wanted to argue against, I think it's, we have to see, against the deists, not against the atheists.
Yeah, it's a big, he's arguing big against, difference.
So he's arguing with people who already have some sort of generic notion that there is some supreme something somewhere, and that's about as clear as you can get oftentimes in English deism. But he's arguing against the natural aspect of deism, and in a way where he says this. He says, if you are affirming X in the natural realm, it's not so irrational. And he would use that kind of double negative approach. He would say it's not so irrational to go ahead and affirm the same analogous kind of thing in the supernatural realm. Mm-hmm. So Butler's analogy in that sense, and I don't want to be too anachronistic here because there are so many things intermingling, but in that sense, Butler's analogy is a kind of common sense approach in which he would say the deists have it about half right. They understand the natural facts properly, but you can't have a religion that's strictly natural. So you have to find a way to move from the natural to the supernatural. So if we believe that certain things die in the winter as they are up here now in Philadelphia, and then two months from now, they're going to spring to life again. If that's the case in the natural realm, Butler would say, it's not so irrational to believe that when we die, we'll spring to life in another realm as well, or in another season or something like that. So he would argue, and then he would argue from infancy to adulthood, and the analogy would be, you know, our growth in the afterlife and things like that.
Yeah.
So the analogy Butler wanted was from the natural to the supernatural. Interesting, though, when you read various Butler scholars, Jeffner is one I have in mind, he says that Butler's dependence on what he called, this is Jeffner now, not Van Til and not others, this is just a philosopher, said Butler's dependence on a rational philosophy really undid his entire argument. So what Van Til was saying, many philosophers have since confirmed, that Butler's analogy, based as it was on a kind of brute fact understanding of the world and maybe a proper understanding of the world in the generic sense, so in that way it's kind of common sense realism, moving from that then to a supplement of the supernatural or an addendum of the supernatural is going to destroy the supernatural itself, because the reality of the brute factness of the world is what it is only if you are basing that on reason alone and have discounted revelation as an authority. Yeah. How then are you going to bring revelation in at some point?
This is why it's so important here to understand the deeper concerns, because Butler's using a phrase called analogical reasoning, and we'll hear the use of the word analogy in Thomas Aquinas, but we also hear it in Van Til. How does Bishop Butler's use of analogy here differ from what Van Til will eventually propose?
Yeah, boy, they're massive differences.
it's a dissertation waiting to happen.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, the word itself is just so muddled now that I'm sort of advocating let's drop it.
Covenant.
But, or, you know, iconic.
Revelational epistemology. Yeah.
Yeah, it's got it. But here's the thing. Just to try to do this as briefly as I can. Thomas Aquinas made the word kind of, you know, he implanted it in theological discourse, really. And when he began to speak about analogy, behind his view of analogy was the principle of participation, which included his doctrine of proportionality, the relation of existence and essence. There's a whole medieval metaphysical vocabulary that you have to recognize in order to understand what Thomas is up to. And even after you do that, I think there are serious problems with Thomas's view. What happened then along comes Butler, and Butler says, I like the idea of analogy, but his analogy is much more evidential and less metaphysical, if I could put it that way. In other words, it's the analogy of if you experience and see X in the world, then it's not so irrational. And I keep using that phrase because that's the way he would want to put it. It's a double negative idea, not so irrational, which really, as Butler would say, reduces us to probability. But it's not so irrational to think that these things could also happen in another realm.
Right.
So why not add it? So the analogy is from the natural to the supernatural. It's an evidential analogy and not a metaphysical analogy. Now, what does Van Til do with all that? Well, two things. Number one, he picks up the term from Bavinck, because Bavinck used it. Bavinck transformed it mostly, not completely, And that's unfortunate. And I have an article that deals with that on Bobbing's realism, where I think he, you know, has a bit too much in there. And I just take off on a shorter critique from Van Til in that and try to expand it a bit. But so Van Til does what I think Bobbing wanted to do. He takes it and completely transforms the notion of analogy. So now it's not simply a metaphysical idea or an evidential idea. Now it's a fundamentally theological idea, such that God is who he is, and everything that is not God is nevertheless analogous to who God is by virtue of God accommodating himself to reveal to us who he is through creation and through his word. So then you've got to do a lot of filling in the blanks. What does analogy mean relative to all of that? And sometimes it's spoken of metaphysically, it's a creator-creature distinction. Sometimes it's spoken of epistemologically. We talk about analogical predication as differing from univocal or equivocal predication. And all of those things need to be filled in. But Van Til's point was exactly right. You have to start with, not work yourself up to by some sort of rational demonstration, but you have to start with the distinction between God and creation. And then when you start with that, you understand everything that we know to be analogous, that is, it's accommodated to us by virtue of God's own free decision to condescend. Bovink will say, in many places, he'll say analogical or ectypal. And there he's referencing back to the Reformed Scholastics and their understanding of the archetype and the ectype. And that's a kind of three-step process of thinking about what God did in the process of creation, just a way to try to help us understand what that looks like. But the term analogy gets bandied about a good bit, and I think oftentimes we're not quite sure what we're saying when we say
image or covenant. That notion of the archetype, ectype is so significant, and that's not present in some of these other versions. So, I agree that analogy is complicated. It seems that Butler's analogy is like the opposite of Occam's razor.
in some ways that's right, because he's saying, you've got this, but it's too simple to have that. You need to add something else, or maybe this would provide hope for you if you add. So, you know, it was that sort of idea that Butler was going for, and as always happens in apologetics, it's rooted in his theology, and that's really Van Til's primary concern. It was his primary concern in his critique of Green. If you're an Arminian in theology, there's no way you can be covenantal in your apologetic. You've got to change your theology in order to understand what's going on in that methodology. If you're Arminian in theology, you have to argue either the way Butler does or the way others do in an Arminian context, where you have this whole vast array of neutral and universally understood facts and ideas. And then from that, you're meant to add by way of addendum or supplementation, the notion of theism and then perhaps even Christianity. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's really good. Well, the other figure that comes up, I think, in the next chapter is Hume. Mm-hmm. Hume is always an interesting guy to talk about. I'm glad Van Til includes him. I think for some, he's kind of even a refreshing figure to deal with, because he's just so kind of honest.
He's my favorite unbeliever.
Not as much of the... Yeah, right. And Nathan Sasser is finishing up his dissertation on Hume, but he doesn't have as much of, I don't know what, maybe like the syncretism of some of the other figures in there. But can you give just a quick take on how Van Til deals with Hume and his skepticism and some of his empiricism?
Yeah, I think it's important because I know there are some misunderstandings out there. I read one critique of Van Til, and it said, you know, Van Til even adopts Hume and Kant and doesn't understand, you know, that he's synthesizing and that sort of thing. And I think what people misunderstand sometimes is that the reason what Van Til wants to do with Hume, and I think this transcends all the debate. You know, there are debates about every philosopher now. Did they really believe X or did they believe Y? And there's revisionism going on all over the place. And that's a product of postmodernism. And some of it might be helpful, but I'm skeptical about most of it. But Van Til is taking what the tradition has thought about Hume, including the tradition immediately after Hume and even during his lifetime. And that is that he is working out a consistent empiricism. And the other empiricists had tried to do that, but they weren't as consistent as they should have been. So Hume's coming at the empirical from as consistent a way as he is able to do, sort of like Descartes did with the rational, you know, let's critique everything. And Hume is saying that knowledge, if we're going to have it, can only be had by way of sense experience. So he's the quintessential evidentialist in that sense. And what Van Til wants us to recognize is that there's a reason why consistent evidentialism or empiricism will lead you to skepticism. Now, it's important to see, I think, that's not just Van Til's judgment. You don't look at Van Til and say, oh, look, well, he called Hume a skeptic. Everybody called Hume a skeptic. The reason Kant wrote what he wrote is because Hume's philosophy had devolved into skepticism almost immediately. And even Hume recognized, you know, when I go play backgammon, I can't apply anything that I'm doing in my study. He saw that his own view was not consistent with the way the rest of us live in the world. So, you know, just parenthetically, my favorite philosopher is Kant because he tries to wed the two, and you know, that also turns into a disaster. So you can kind of see that the product of the best of Hume in Kant. But what Hume is doing is he's saying, I'm going to be only and always evidential. And then as he does that, he begins to chip away at what most of us understand to be the foundations of living in the world on a day-to-day basis. And Van Til says, if you want to be evidential without Christianity, this is what it's going to look like. So if it doesn't look like this, if it doesn't look like Hume, utter skepticism, then what does it look like? Well, it looks like Immanuel Kant. And so he has some critiques of Kant as well. Kant was the one who said Hume woke him up from his dogmatic slumbers. And so Kant begins to write the critique of pure reason to answer, you know, the burning question that all people have, and that is, are synthetic a priori judgments possible? That's what most of America is lying awake thinking at night. Are synthetic a priori judgments possible?
And it's all Kant over says, Fox well, News. Donald Trump, that's his main campaign platform.
Yeah, well, that's where it is. It's in the fiber of America. So what Kant is trying to do is say Hume had it about half right in his understanding of analytic and synthetic judgments, but Kant said, we've got to be able to play backgammon. He's not saying this actually, but he's saying we've got to be able to play backgammon and recognize that there's a philosophical way to justify our activity. Yeah. In other words, cause and effect have to be justified. And so that's justified by way of synthetic a priori. But so what Van Til does is say, if you don't want Hume, your only two options philosophically are Immanuel Kant and Thomas Reed. Reed was the other side of the equation. He didn't get much press until later on. Kant was the initial genius in trying to develop a critical philosophy, but common sense realism came after that. So Van Til is saying, pox on all your houses. None of this is going to provide you what you want in terms of a proper understanding of evidence. The only way you can have a proper understanding of evidence is to see evidence in a Christian theistic way. And so the apologetic argument is an attempt to show, number one, negatively, philosophy still has not been able to provide a justification even for the fact that we assert, number one. Number two, positively, only Christianity is able to do this because Christianity understands facts as created facts and therefore initially understood and interpreted by God, not by man.
Okay, and so just a follow-up and a point of clarification on that, some listeners may be wondering at this point, so when we're talking about evidences, are we limiting that to empirical evidence in the discussion that Van Til is having with these figures, or can there be non-empirical evidences as well?
Yeah, Van Til would say everything is an evidence of who God is. And so, you know, as I've said before, it's not five ways, as Aquinas said, it's 5 trillion zillion bazillion, whatever the number is, ways. Every fact, including our concepts, our ideas, the universal, the particular, everything evidences the existence of God. And what he's wanting to do is talk about creation as evidence. And that makes evidence Christian theistic because there is no creation apart from Christian theism.
So we see that, you know, we have the two options, which Van Til rejects this false dichotomy, either between, if you don't want Hume, then take Kant or take Reed. Well, many Christians have taken Reed. Old Princeton did. And now there's this the strand of Christian philosophy that has risen up largely through the work of Alvin Plantinga. Let's go back to that initially. You mentioned in the foreword speaking about foundations and foundationalism. If we're going to reject Plantinga, and if Van Til doesn't want to have that notion of foundationalism, we're speaking anachronistically here, but applying Van Til to Plantinga, then what does that mean? Is that just postmodernism? What if we reject foundationalism, what's the alternative?
Right, good. See, I think it's important to recognize that, well, there was a book written years ago by D.Z. Phillips. He was a Wittgensteinian, a British philosopher. I had the opportunity to meet one time and chat with him about it. But he wrote a book, and he sort of compares Plantinga and Van Til and says, here's the way the two operate. And there was not enough of a critical distinction there in what they do. I think they're, you can find coincidences between the two men because they're both, in one sense, wanting to try to do the same thing. So planning as deconstruction, oftentimes, of various philosophical systems is just absolutely brilliant. But Phillips was wanting to make the point, D.Z. Phillips, that Van Til, like Plantinga, as a foundationalist. Now, let me just say, first, he isn't. And let me try to explain why he's not. Foundationalism, as a technical term in philosophy, has to do with the idea that you have foundational beliefs, what Plantinga calls properly basic beliefs, what Reid would call common sense beliefs.
Or Descartes, you know, those indubitable.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're a category, mm-hmm. self-evident, evident to the senses, incorrigible. Those kinds of beliefs that you have, Reid would say, and Plantinga picks up on this. He's not the first, obviously. It's been replete really since Reid wrote more and less in the history of philosophy. But you have these beliefs that are not able or needed to be justified. You don't have to justify. These beliefs are what they are by virtue of you having them. That really is the way it's discussed. So, one of the beliefs is I didn't come to exist 5 minutes ago. Can I prove that? Well, I could show you pictures of me yesterday, and someone say, well, that could have been produced, you know, a different way. So the idea is you don't have to justify that. That's a belief that's properly basic. It's foundational. And all of your other beliefs flow from those properly basic or foundational beliefs. And that's why it's called foundationalism. Some philosophers, Volter Short, Plantinga, and others would want to try to argue, at least they used to try to argue, that this really can move all the way back to Plato. And then you see it in various ways in the philosophical tradition. So the question then is Van Til just arguing the same thing, that you have properly basic beliefs like belief in God, and you believe in God, and then everything else flows from that belief? The answer is no. And the reason he's arguing no, the reason I'm arguing no, he didn't put it in these terms, is because for Van Til, there's a vast, substantial difference, radical difference, between foundations in common sense realism, or properly basic beliefs in common sense realism, the difference between that and what Christians believe as foundational. We do believe there are foundations to everything that we know and believe, and typically in the history of theology, we've talked about too, a foundation of existence, which is God himself, and a foundation of knowledge, which is God's revelation. So those are foundations that inform. In one sense, they actually create, in terms of the foundation of existence. God creates and then, by virtue of revelation, informs everything else that we know. So when we're talking about evidences, of course, Van Til would say, as Reformed theology has always said in its best lights, it would say, in order to articulate anything, in order to predicate anything, in order for me to make one sentence and for that sentence to be meaningful, number one, God has to exist, and number two, he has to have revealed himself, both in creation and in his word. So in that sense, those are foundations, but those foundations, I've tried to make the argument elsewhere, and Bovink makes this argument in his works even more than Van Til does. Those foundations are principia. They are not just principles, which is how the word might come over in English, but sources and foundations of existence and of knowledge. So that brings any kind of common sense idea. I believe that I existed more than 5 minutes ago. That's a common sense belief. But does that belief itself need to be grounded in something? And that's the apologetic question. Van Til would never say that if someone believes they existed more than 5 minutes ago, that their existence is absolutely false, period, the end. He would say that if they're not Christians, if they're unbelievers, they can't justify that statement meaningfully, mm-hmm. because in order to do that, you have to justify who you are as a person and what it means to be more than 5 minutes old and how that relates to the rest of the world. All the individual facts of the world have to come together in some kind of coherent way, and you can't do that apart from Christianity. So the point he's making is the foundations of God's existence and God's revelation are foundations for everyone, and then acknowledging those foundations allows us to justify the very things that we assert and to have a rationale for those things that we predicate. That's the apologetic point he wants to make, and it's always an apologetic point. So that's not foundationalism, that's Christian theism. And it goes beyond foundationalism to justify the common sense beliefs that most of us hold. Van Til wouldn't oppose those. That's why he favors Kant in one sense, in the sense that he borrows Kant's terminology, transcendental critique, and brings it over into his apologetic. That's just a heuristic device. Pedagogically, he's trying to say what Kant was trying to do, he wasn't able to do. It just wound up in a sort of solipsistic view that, you know, your world exists in your own mind, sure. alone. So Kant couldn't do it. Van Til says the only way you're truly transcendental, that is where you have a critical view, properly critical view of everything apologetically, is you bring that over into Christianity. And in a transcendental understanding, you say, okay, given that fact, and see, there's the givenness of it. That's a kind of common sense idea. Given that fact or that experience, then you ask, what are the presuppositions behind it and which make it possible? That's the transcendental thrust of his apologetic approach. And so in that sense, you see, it's not foundationalism, but it takes a kind of common sense idea and says those ideas themselves have to be justified. As I've mentioned before in George Marsden's critique of old Princeton and apologetics in academia in the 19th century, he does a masterful job of showing why and how common sense realism failed, especially in the face of what was becoming a Darwinian revolution.
On the question of science, then, mentioning Darwin, I think a lot of people will, or some people will automatically think of the time frame that Van Til is writing this, kind of early 20th century, and then a philosophical revolution in some sense with logical positivism coming on the scene around that same time. You mentioned a little bit about positivism in there, and just wondering what was the interaction there, if anything, between Van Til and what was emerging then with logical positivism and their take on science as it relates to what we're talking about regarding evidences.
Yeah, you know, one of the interesting things I wish I'd been able to ask him back in the day is you know, as I say in the foreword, the initial syllabus, I think the first one or two. The end of the book deals with the problem of evil and evolution. So he's taking on Darwinism. Then he eventually sort of incorporates a bit of that into some other chapters, but he adds instead, in most of the syllabuses after that, he adds a chapter on general psychology and then the psychology of religion. Now that in 21st century ears, that sounds a bit odd, but I think it's important to see that what was happening in psychology in Van Til's time, and let me just say parenthetically before I get back to that, Dr. Knudsen, when he was at Westminster, he was counseled by Van Til to go study at the Free University of Amsterdam. I think Van Til later wished he hadn't counseled him in that direction, but Knudsen studied at the Free University, and he did his dissertation on Carl Jung on a psychology dissertation in philosophy. So the point is, during say the mid 20th century, psychology had very much a kind of scientific/philosophical tenor about it, so that Van Til wanted to take on psychologists and psychology of religion to show how the notion of the soul, the psyche, the soul, in psychology in a secular context really was thought of as a kind of brute fact. It was something that psychologists had taken over to some extent from philosophy. And to show that those those brute, you know, kind of a positivistic notion of the soul, the immortality of the soul, a very, very Platonic idea. And Van Til wants to try to show this is not a Christian idea, the immortality. So as if it existed previous and then is inherited once we are who we are. That was Plato's idea, kind of inserted into us. So knowledge for Plato was just reminiscent, remembering what you knew when you were only a soul in your previous existence. And then the soul, the form is put into the matter and you become a human being and all that sort of Greek gibberish. That's not the way it happens in Christianity. And Van Til makes the point. The body-soul relationship is not a positivistic one. We're not brute facts as soul and body. But we're image of God, and that changes the way you think about soul and body. The only reason they're going to be separated in the intermediate state is because of the reality of sin. Otherwise, we're an integrity. There's an integral relationship of soul and body, and you can only recognize that in the context of creation. So the psychology and psychology of religion scientific field is the way in which Van Til gets at positivism in his day. In trying to show people that you cannot have a non-Christian / secular understanding of body and soul and recognize in any way who people really are. I wondered as I was going through this, and I don't know, maybe Dave Pallison would know. I don't know if some of this is what influenced Jay Adams initially or not, but there's enough in there in terms of what Van Til has done. I know Van Til influenced Adams. There wouldn't be biblical counseling if there hadn't been Van Til. So I know the influence was there in a generic sense, but I wonder if Van Til's discussion, and he has a syllabus on the psychology of religion, I wonder if that whole discussion was what motivated Adams specifically, not just generally, in terms of his own approach to biblical counseling.
That's really interesting. You
know, there's so much in this book. In addition to that, right at the beginning, Van Til speaks about, you know, that he's offering a front on the philosophy of science. And I like that turn of phrase, philosophy of science, and his specific use of that rather than just attacking science, as it were. Because as Christians, in knowing that all truth is God's truth, we should be able to investigate the world. God has revealed himself through the things that have been made, and he's Lord over it all. So Van Til doesn't seek to attack science, as it were, but science which is based upon unbelieving presuppositions and unbelieving foundations.
That's a really important point, Camden, because I think that is one of those things that people miss oftentimes. And you could say the same thing about logic and a lot of things that Van Til writes about. He's writing about philosophy of science before Kuhn was around or any of those folks, and he's tackling not what scientists do in the laboratory, right, or what they see in the microscope. He's tackling how do they think about their own methodology in relation to who they are as people. That's an important apologetic.
They're often uncritical about those things, haven't even considered or examined the foundations of their own discipline. And you read a guy like Karl Popper,
right,
for example, who starts to uncover some of those things, and not from our Reformed Christian perspective, but you could sympathize with a lot of his criticisms, and you could see a lot of scientists becoming very uneasy with their own discipline and the limitations that it has.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, because, you know, one of the things that people have said to me recently in criticism of Van Til is I say, well, okay, you've got revelation, you've got the existence of God. Those are foundational. But both of those things presuppose the fact that I have to see and hear and touch and feel and think. And, you know, Van Til, of course, he knew all of that. That's not like that's big news. But the question is, who's the one hearing and seeing and touching and feeling and thinking? And how does that relate to what it is we see and hear and touch and feel and think? So there's a relationship that none of that can be thought of in abstraction. There's a relationship of all of that, the empirical, to the person. And that's when you get into the philosophy of X. And the same is the case with respect to logic. Yeah. We sometimes talk about logic like it's just there and anyone can take it. Anyone who does take it is doing the same thing. And Van Til said, well, not really, because if logic legislates what's possible and impossible, then we have a serious problem with respect to who God is.
Even last night I was watching the movie Spotlight, which is up for an Academy Award, and it deals with the Boston Globe's investigation into the Catholic Church with all of their recent abuse scandals. And, you know, there's so many throwaway statements in movies and TV and pop culture where someone will say, well, we know that knowledge is one thing, but faith is something different. And there's this dichotomy that's split between the realm of religion or your faith, which doesn't operate according to the rest of the world or whatever. And Van Til wants to uncover the foundations of both and say, no, we rest in all matters upon the triune God of Scripture. Yeah. There's not this a way in which we can artificially divide those two. And as he attacks the philosophy of science here and unbelieving thought, and he moves from Butler's analogy to Hume and Kant and dives down into some very, very deep-seated beliefs, Van Til uncovers some important things. All the way from 1930, yeah, 1930.
Yeah. Yeah, from 19th, the first thing he wrote, and that's one of the reasons so important. I think it's also important to see from day one of his teaching at Westminster until he retired in the early 1970s, he never wavered. And I've never read anybody who can get at the foundations of unbelief and begin to talk about Christianity in the context of those foundations in a way that Van Til can do. I've just never read anybody who can do it. So his genius is just, to me, it's just unparalleled. I've never seen anything like it. That doesn't mean he's abundantly clear on every page, but it means if you take the time to read it and absorb it, it will change
Absolutely.
Your life.
Well, thanks so much for taking the time today to discuss this. Thanks also for revisiting this book and providing a foreword and the explanatory notes. I also want to thank PNR so much for being willing to publish this. I know I'm looking forward to more volumes if that's on the horizon. But what we have so far is starting to build up, and it's a lovely combination and a lovely set of important books.
Yeah, I've got my hard copy here, so that yours should be.
All right. Well, you check out Westminster's website. You can find out more information about Dr. Oliphant and what he's up to. I'll point you to faculty.wts.edu, and there you'll find information about all the faculty members at Westminster, and you can find profiles on each of them, which include, your standard CV items, but they'll also have links to all sorts of different resources, posts, articles, books, lectures, courses, sermons, different speaking events, you name it. It's a wonderful place to stay in touch with what the seminary is doing in and through its faculty. And that's an important thing. So you can find them at faculty.wts.edu. Of course, you can also find links to Westminster Seminary there. You can find links to the Westminster Bookstore at WTSBooks.com, where we hope you'll pick up a copy of this title, Christian Theistic Evidences by Cornelius Van Til, second edition, now edited by our guest today, Dr. Scott Oliphant. You can find us online at reformedforum.org. Get in touch with us at mail@reformedforum.org or by tweeting us at reformedforum. I want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.